Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Talk is about to begin. Hey, 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 come on in.
Welcome back to Buckeye Talk. I'm Nathan Baird from Cleveland.com along with Dudley and Maurice. I warned you last week that it might be the last Monday Madness in a while. I guess I was right because this isn't coming to you till Tuesday. But you get one more shot of Doug and I coming out of the NFL draft and talking about some of the potentially pending seismic changes that are coming to NCAA sports. But we're starting off with an OSU topic, as always, and we're coming out of the NFL draft. We're actually recording this pretty early in the draft weekend to get ahead of things. But obviously, we start off with Thursday night, Ohio State receiver at number 10, Ohio State receiver at number 11, former Ohio State receiver at number 12. And it got me to thinking, when I came here in 2019, Ohio State had a reputation either as being DBU or edge rusher U, and have we now completely shifted over to this being contending for either wide receiver U or QB U? And it's certainly, I think you would make the case right now, there aren't, I don't know what other, I haven't researched like what other programs deserve to be called wide receiver U, but a combination of what some guys like Michael Thomas and Terry McLaurin are doing in the NFL and what we're now seeing in the draft and what we're seeing as far as Ohio State producing talent, it's definitely trending in that direction.
Yeah, it's interesting because it feels like, oh, yeah, no, this is the Ohio State receiver room, right? This is what you do. But, like, this is not what it has been. They had not had a first-round pick in a long time. This really is the beginning, and yes, Michael Thomas and Terry McLaurin are shining examples of guys who have become great NFL players, but McLaurin was a third round pick. Thomas was a second round pick. This idea, and it is funny, Nathan, and this is how sports works, right? You're an expert on your team. So everybody listening, nobody listening to this is like, oh, Ohio State has good receivers. But you go through like the national college people and NFL people. And when the three guys went in a row, Garrett Wilson, Chris Olave, and then Jameson Williams as a former Buckeye. I mean, that's like everybody was saying, oh my gosh, what a recruiting tool for Ohio State. Holy moly, they were in the same room. And we live it every day. But for people who don't, they know those guys are good. But the draft, one of the reasons that people love the draft so much is because it is the ultimate crossover, right? There's college fan bases and there's NFL fan bases, and tons of people love both. But there are also some people who really only lean in on one or the other. And this is the day where you bring everybody together. And sometimes you sort of introduce NFL people to what you think is a known quantity. This is a reality in college football. What are you being surprised about? But that was part of that was real when the NFL when the receivers went like that. So I do think this is a new era, and I do think it will feed on itself. And I do think this has a chance. I would say receiver before quarterback, but I do think in 5 years, if you're saying Ohio State is what you, I think it might be receiver, right?
I think it definitely is trending in that direction. I thought it would be fun to kind of go position by position and say, is this trending towards being that positional U for Ohio State? Is it trending away from that? Or is it just kind of holding steady? Because I think that's happening in a couple of positions too. But wide receiver is the one where all three things are really potentially syncing up. If Michael Thomas very recently was the best wide receiver in the NFL. Mm-hmm. Like he was, I think, widely considered the best wide receiver in the NFL. So you've already got that going for you. Like you produced the guy. And then on top of that, you had the production that was happening at the college level and then leading to what we saw last night, especially Olave and Wilson being those two picks back-to-back at 10 and 11. You still have Jackson Smith and Jigba hanging out. That's the other part of the narrative from last night was everybody was like, hey, those three guys just went back-to-back-to-back. Wait till you see this guy they left behind, like the one who's coming next year. And then on top of that, being a room that just consistently every year, Brian Hartline kind of gets to go get who he wants. And sometimes it's the number one guy in the country. And sometimes it's a guy who's like number 12 or 15 or even less than that when Ohio State first gets a commitment from him, but he happens to keep climbing and climbing, and climbing like Jackson Smith and Jigba. The forces are coming from just a lot of angles as far as this being a wide receiver identity school. But I think it's also very much tied into what Ryan Day is doing in the quarterback room. And we've talked about this before, but how those two forces kind of play off of each other. The wide receivers want to come play with the best quarterbacks. In order to keep getting the best quarterbacks, you have to be able to point across the hall and say, look at who we're going to have here for you to throw to.
So this was, though, the first round pick at receiver for Ohio State since Ted Ginn Jr. in 2007, which feels crazy. They had two receivers also that year, the first round, Ted Ginn Jr. and Anthony Gonzalez. And that had followed on Santonio Holmes being a first round pick the year before. So that's pretty similar to this. And I covered those guys. Most people listening to this are very aware of that little era of Ohio State receiverdom. But then that didn't keep going. So that's the thing here, Nathan, that this is right. This does feel like the beginning of something because it's not just you happen to recruit some talented guys right on top of each other. It's a way of doing business. It's the way the offense runs. It's how Ryan Day wants to play. It's how Brian Hartline wants to run a receiver room. And so the difference here is being like, hey, we have good guys and we have guys who get drafted and being the place that pumps out first rounders time after time. And we all see that. And the other thing that happened here is, well, who would have been the other place to challenge this? Well, Lincoln Riley at Oklahoma, but even they did not, as much as they were cranking out quarterbacks and they had a great passing game. You know, CD Lamb was a great receiver. They had some, it was a first rounder. They had some other guys come through there, but they weren't putting two NFL receivers out there every year. And now Lincoln Riley's somewhere else. So maybe USC develops into this and it's Ohio State versus USC for wide receiver U, but I'm not even necessarily sure like who the other challengers would be right now. Certainly LSU had a run there for a while, but now is that what Brian Kelly's going to do? I don't know. And Bama, right? Bama had that run for a while, but Bama is now currently taking every transfer receiver they can get because they haven't been developing wide receivers. And then the difference there is, it's the position coach. There is continuity here. And someday Brian Hartline won't be the Ohio State receivers coach. And just like someday Larry Johnson won't be the Ohio State defensive line coach. It will be interesting to see how much of it in the end is the position coach within the structure of the program, or how much can the program keep it going? Because I think when you look at some of those other places, hey, maybe why won't they keep it going as consistently is because, well, they don't have the same kind of continuity at the position coach level that Ohio State has had. And we think will continue to have with Brian Hartline until he decides he wants to be a head coach.
Yeah. And I think that's a very important point to make because you also saw it a little bit in the secondary too. Like, you know, you had the continuity of Kerry Combs for several years at a crucial time when they were producing some, you know, high level defensive backs. And that's what kind of led to that identity as well. So I thought, let's go position by position. We both say wide receiver U, clearly they're trending up towards that, trending in the direction of wide receiver U. I think we would both say also trending in the direction of quarterback U. You've had Heisman finalist Dwayne Haskins, Heisman finalist Justin Fields, Heisman finalist CJ Stroud, continuing to land high-level guys year after year. Maybe until you actually win a Heisman or something. I don't know if but I don't know that there are programs out there. Oklahoma would maybe be the only one that I can think of that has so consistently produced guys who you think are just like automatically going to New York and automatically going to be first round guys.
Yeah. I guess Alabama, they have the current quarterback Heisman winner, and Tua was a finalist and Mac Jones was a finalist. So their last three starting quarterbacks, and Jalen Hurts had a good run there and then left and then was a finalist somewhere else. So that's pretty good.
Oklahoma. Too. Yeah. Yeah. So Oklahoma, there's been some weird sharing in here, the way Ohio State and Alabama get to share Jameson Williams, and there's been some quarterback sharing, but I think you're right. Alabama should be in that. So what about the positions where, again, like I said, just a couple years ago, you would have said Ohio State, I even wrote a piece about DBU and can Ohio State claim being called DBU? And this was coming out of the 2020 draft. So, or I think it may have been, or even going into it. I don't know if Okuda and Arnett and those guys had been drafted yet, but it was at that moment. And that's a point where you have two first round picks, Jeff Okuda, third overall, Damon Arnett at 19 or 20. You then had even another guy down in the sixth round, Jordan Fuller. But it seemed like there was more coming at that point. Not maybe to the extent that there is with this receiver room and the momentum that you're seeing in quarterback for Ohio State, but still, like, you felt like things hadn't crested. It felt like a moment where things were still trending up. And then with what's happened since then, Damon Arnett's not in football right now for off-the-field situations, and he wasn't playing that well when he did play. Jeff Okuda, a lot of injuries in the NFL so far, has not gotten his feet set. Then Jordan Fuller turned out to be the best NFL player of that draft group as far as DBs for Ohio State so far. You follow that up with Sean Wade being only a fifth-round pick and him not really getting things started yet. You follow that up with the way that the secondary has been playing for Ohio State. I mean, it was a problem in both of the last 2 years in different ways. I think Ohio State has definitely trended away from that identity. They still have guys in the NFL who've been producing, but those guys are getting older by the year. And as those guys graduate out, I don't know that this crop has the people to replace them. I feel like this coming Ohio State season it's something I've been meaning to write. Like if they want that DBU identity, this 2022 secondary maybe needs to be the one that gets it back.
Yeah, and we're going to find out, again, talking about when is stuff tied to a position coach and when is it not. Feels like this might be tied to a position coach, because this kind of fell off when Kerry Combs left for the NFL initially, and then he came back and now he's gone again. So I don't know. Is there now? Listen, Ohio State had some great DBs before also, right? Malcolm Jenkins and Sean Springs and Antoine Winfield, and right, we know that. So it's not like Kerry Combs didn't invent defensive back play at Ohio State. But that runs Kerry Combs, man. Now, Bradley Roby was recruited during the Tressel era, but he played for Kerry Combs, and Kerry Combs helped him get there, and then the rest of that run is Kerry Combs. So I don't know, and it does, like, when you think about, like, the Big Ten, and that Ohio State, why should Ohio State be DBU? It's not a passing league. They don't get tested as much. It's not like the Midwest is necessarily a recruiting hotbed for defensive backs, right? Like, why should Ohio State be DBU? So I don't know how long to hold on to that, but I just did quick math of the 15 drafts since the last receiver was taken in the first round for Ohio State, not counting this year, since Ted Ginn Jr. in 2007. Ohio State had 22 first-round picks in those next 15 years. 9 of them were defensive backs. So that's almost practically half the first-rounders were defensive backs. Now, that's thrown in some safeties like Malik Hooker in with all the corners, but it's mostly corners. five defensive ends and then two each at running back, linebacker, offensive line, and quarterback. So, I mean, if we look at that, Nathan, there's no, it's like, well, what are they? It's DBU, man. It's not anything else. It's nine first round picks in 15 years. I just don't know if they'll retain that.
Yeah, it was April 15th, 2020 when I wrote this piece. So going into that draft, and I had based it, I kind of tried to do a scientific analysis, and I had based it on college credentials, the draft, star power, and NFL production. And then also, but then the fifth category was looking ahead and, you know, which school had the advantage in all those categories. And overall, I came to LSU being the one who most deserved to be called DBU for, you know, they had had, they really won the college credentials one. They really were also kind of winning star power. You had, you know, multiple like all pro guys, you know, Tyrann Mathieu, those sort of guys. Ohio State, though, won out on the draft, as you just mentioned. And then the crucial one that had them like right on the cusp was looking ahead, because we knew that Jeff Okuda was going to be a high draft pick. We thought, and Damon Arnett, we assumed was going to be a fairly high draft pick. We didn't expect him to go quite as high as he did. We thought then, though, that Sean Wade is coming. We thought some other things were coming. Now, while that has not happened, Denzel Ward just signed the most lucrative cornerback contract in NFL history. Marshawn Lattimore is walking around with a pretty fat wallet. So there's still very relevant defensive backs from Ohio State, like still performing in the NFL right now. Some of those guys were on the tail end of that run that you were talking about that has a pretty long tail that extends back. And there may be some of those guys also, there's some guys cycling out who aren't maybe in the prime of their careers anymore. So if you had to characterize it, would you say the DBU status for Ohio State, is it trending down? Would you argue that it's still sort of like holding from where it has been, that they don't deserve that title, but they haven't really fallen off from contending for it, if you know what I mean?
No, and I think when you factor in the guys who are getting it done now, that Denzel Ward contract got everybody's attention. Marshawn Lattimore's contract got everybody's attention. Those are the two guys leading the way right now, but they're still young in their careers. And if they hold on, if they continue to be excellent NFL players who are cashing big checks until Denzel Burke and Jordan Hancock and the next crop of guys get there, then you'll maintain it. Because I do think you make a good point. A lot of it is top down. It's who's in the NFL that was from your place. And even if you had a little gap, if you're still getting big time attention, that's what it's about. So I do. They have a couple guys, you know, Garen Conley, not as much in the league as you said. Damon Arnett, Jeff Okuda has had some injury issues. Jeff Okuda is in danger of being a bust. Like, that is the third overall pick for a terrible team who has basically given the Lions nothing for 2 years. And again, yeah, it is very injury related. But that doesn't, you don't always just get a break on that like that. Right. The Lions are trying to do something here, and Jeff Okuda, they drafted him to be right in the middle of that. And when you think about, okay, well, who, Joe Burrow was the number one pick in that draft. Chase Young was number two. Jeff Okuda was number three. You look at what Joe Burrow's done in 2 years. Chase has been pretty good. Maybe, I mean, like, pretty good. He's good.
And yeah, so the injuries really threw him off last year too.
That's tough for Jeff. And I like Jeff a lot. I thought Jeff had everything. So I'm surprised, but again, you can't control the injuries. But it's going to be on Ward and Lattimore for a while to carry this. But I do. But then again, Jordan Hancock, Kalen Johnson, Denzel Burke, that's a lot of, like, mm-hmm, that's a crop that came in while Kerry Combs was here then again. Yep. So that now it's on Tim Walton, Perry Eliano. And then, as we know, there is geographic recruiting. There's guys you come across. Brian Hartline was all over Denzel Burke and was like, this guy's a DB, right? So, I mean, this is, you have to have your other guys helping too, but we're really going to find out. And I know Walton and Eliana are out there getting after it, but they, and I do think, Nathan, it's important for them to stay attached to that because they're still selling DBU. There are enough DBU for Perry Eliano and Tim Walton to go sell that to guys still, because they can have the graphic about the $100 million contract for Denzel Ward. But if you let it get away from you and then you can't sell it anymore, then it's harder to get it back.
Yeah, I had originally thought that I would put a down on this. I think I would probably call it even, but say that because again, when I did that analysis a couple of years ago, I wasn't calling them DBU. I thought they were below at least LSU. But you have to also say that they are trending away from being as close to contending for that title as they were. I think this 2022 season, this group of DBs that they have right now, needs to sort of kind of push that back in our direction. And Jeff Okuda can change that too, still, I assume, because a lot of it was sort of tied up in what he was going to do in the coming years. I think it's okay to use the word bust because I've said this before, like a person isn't a commodity, but their athletic performance is a commodity. So Jeff Okuda as a person is not a bust, but Jeff Okuda as the number three pick in the draft might be a bust. Edge rusher U, and I think it's I would call edge U instead of just D-line U, right? Because it's really more about the pass rushing guys. It's more about the defensive ends as far as like where Ohio State really could almost like could stake that claim that it was producing them better than anybody else in the country. Would you say even up or down at edge rusher U?
I would say not down yet for sure. I think it's – listen, when you go – Bosa Young, and you go second pick, and you're only a couple drafts removed from that, that's still kind of trending up. They just, well, I'll have to see where Tyreek, well, we're recording this before the draft. Tyreek Smith's going to be a drafted guy. I guess I would say even right now. And again, can they hold on until maybe they get a boost from Zach Harrison, JT Tumaloa, Jack Sawyer when it's their time to go in the draft. But I would say even.
Yeah, I think you could say even because you could probably, I think, still argue that Ohio State should be number one. I mean, with those three guys in a row, what they did in college, how they transitioned it to the NFL. I mean, Chase Young's only had two seasons. He was fantastic as a rookie and then got hurt last year. So maybe his 2022 season has to carry some weight in this argument. But speaking of contracts, like I think the Bosas are both about to get massive contracts here in the coming years. I don't remember when their deals run out, but like when their free agency comes up, I think it's going to be very lucrative for them. Mm-hmm. So that's going to put Ohio State, get some momentum going. And then, as we said, like Ohio State is, it's another season where the guys who are actually playing there in 2022 can change this conversation a little bit. If you get a breakthrough from JT Tuimoloau, if you get a breakthrough from Jack Sawyer, if Zach Harrison elevates beyond this, that's sort of like good but not great level play, if he gets up towards great, then it helps that conversation. But it, as you said before, it is really about any program that's trying to claim this, they point to the NFL, whether that's DBU, QBU, this position. And at the top of that right now in the NFL is still a lot of Ohio State guys.
And Cam Hayward is putting together a potential Hall of Fame career, right, as an Ohio State defensive end who's been in the league for well over a decade now. And he still has some juice. He's still acknowledged. And that gets Ohio State's name out there, too. So it is that three-player run for the most part. When you look back in the last 15 years, the five defensive ends drafted in the first round are the two Bosas, Chase Young, Cam Hayward, and then Vernon Golston, who was a bust in the classic sense of the word, just was not a good NFL player, is one of the bigger busts in the last 15 years of the draft, frankly. But Cam really helps too, so that it's not only three guys, but nobody else, no other team, right, could really come close to pointing to the Bosas and Chase Young. Is there somebody?
I'm, you know, again, I didn't go back and research, and just off the top of my head, though, no, like I can't think of who else has produced that many guys at this same cluster. I bet if you were to go back over, somebody would say like, well, over 20 years, such and such team has had, you know, like Miami or somebody has had that many in that period. You know, I think Florida State has produced some guys. I mean, everybody down south has produced those kinds of talents, really. But no, I think Ohio State, you could still claim that they are number one. And so that's where the one where I think just saying that they've stayed even is not a bad thing. There was one other position where I thought you could argue that Ohio State has maybe held even wherever it is on the list of competing for that positional title. And that's RBU. I think there was a time when running back, when I was growing up, I thought running back was pretty synonymous with Ohio State. It seemed like there always were really great running backs here. And, you know, Zeke Elliott's the last NFL one that Ohio State has produced that has been like a consistent guy. But again, J.K. Dobbins got there, looked good, got hurt. Trey Sermon was a third round pick. So he turned basically like three games into Ohio State being into a third round pick.
And overdrafted, then you got, overdrafted, yeah,
but, overdrafted, but was drafted in the third round. And because part of this is what you do in college that that gets you drafted to a certain level too. I mean, all those things are factors in this. And then you've got Trevon Henderson here, who looks like he could be a solid addition to your argument as to whether or not they are RBU. So because Ezekiel Elliott looks like he's trailing off, I think I would say that they're only sort of holding even at RBU, but they are sort of holding their own at this position, I think.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, obviously shorter shelf lives for running backs. Beanie Wells having his career cut short. That guy was a first round pick, and just with the leg injuries, we never got to see in the NFL really what he could be. Carlos Hyde had a nice little career, has hung around as a guy who still gets carries in the NFL. Like, hey, that guy was a very productive running back for Ohio State as their starting running back for a couple of years. And I wasn't 1,000% sure what he'd be in the NFL. I think he's been better in the NFL than I anticipated. So then you always have to have a guy on top. So Zeke, man, Zeke's in the, you know, whatever the, what's the pot he jumps in? He jumps in the pot and eats the soup. He jumps in the Salvation Army pot, jumps in the Salvation Army pot and comes out and says, give me some soup. Give me some soup. Feed me. So Zeke, I mean, like Zeke, give me some quesadilla explosion. Like I like the soup when you get the little like tortilla strips on top of the soup. I'd be doing that. I'd be eating the soup and then I'd be sprinkling. I'm doing that with my fingers. I'm sprinkling the tortilla strips on my soup. Zeke is a frontline guy and all this stuff. If you want to, you have to have your frontline guy. It's like, oh, LSU as a case, as wide receiver, you. It's like, yeah, because Odell is out there tearing it up. And then as Odell was peeling, you know, sort of coming down a little bit, here came Justin Jefferson and Ja'Marr Chase. And it's like, yes, that place. They didn't have to have eight first round picks in between Odell Beckham Jr. and Justin Jefferson, right? It was okay. But Odell had so much juice that he carried the load. Zeke, peak Zeke, had almost as much juice as anybody in the league. And he is spreading the gospel of Ohio State running backs. That is huge. Now, shorter shelf life. So who's next? But he's not gone. He's not going anywhere. So if JK can be healthy, and that's just terrible luck for JK to get hurt in the preseason last year for Baltimore when he was going to be their number one running back, assuming he's back as their number one guy. And then Trevion's coming in a couple of years. You got a chance to keep that going. So you stay in that conversation, I think. So I think they're even, right? They're not falling off. Not with Zeke,
and again, I don't think you necessarily have to be like one of the top five contenders, because we're talking about anywhere you are on the spectrum. Just where is the momentum right now? And I would still argue that they're hanging in there. The other thing you got to remember with running back is, unlike DBU, unlike even wide receiver U, you're not putting two, three guys into the league at once, or even in like maybe a 2 year span. It's more sporadic. You're only producing like one star running back at a time. So you have to kind of adjust it the way you evaluate. More similar to quarterbacks, really. Yeah. So there's two other positions that I put on this list, and that was OLU and LBU. Both of which I argue Ohio State is trending down from contending for those. Do you agree?
Yes. They have not developed the offensive line guys, even when you look like Wyatt Davis has not popped in Minnesota right away. Listen, Corey Linsley, really good. Josh Myers looked ready, good. Taylor Decker, a good, solid starting offensive tackle as a first-round pick. They don't regret that pick. He's not an all-pro necessarily, but he's a good, solid guy. They did have some other guys kind of along the way. Listen, Andrew Norwell made a gazillion dollars as a guy who didn't get drafted and then got a huge free agent contract. So Andrew Norwell has been good, but they just haven't done it as much lately, which is why it'll be interesting a year from now after our pod predicting the 2023 NFL draft, if they have Paris Johnson and DeJuan Jones both go very high, we might be, what could they be next? Are they trending up there? But maybe not, because then those guys will go pro and then we'll be like, who are the tackles? And then we'll be, which is, we've already done that. We're already playing who are the tackles. So yes, I think they're trending down. And then linebacker, I just don't know how that's coming back, because the two first round picks in the last 15 years are Ryan Shazier and Darren Lee. And it feels like they're constantly looking for the next Ryan Shazier and Darren Lee. And we're not exactly sure right now who those guys are.
I suppose with linebacker, it's possible that the game is changing enough that there will be sort of a revisionist evaluation of something at some point. And now, you know, Pete Werner was a second round pick. If he becomes a thing in the NFL, like that, you give them some credit for that. The offensive line thing, though, it's like, what year was Taylor Decker? Like at some point
16.
Yeah. So that's a long time to me for Ohio State not to have produced a first round pick on the offensive line. Like now you're getting up, this will be the fifth or sixth draft in a row now where they haven't produced
17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, six.
This will be sixth. Yeah. That's just that Ohio State should have more first round offensive line guys than that, I think. I know it's hard, but it's also kind of not hard. Like if you're Ohio State, you're attracting the best offensive line talent in the country. And you've got two that are starting every year, and tackles are such a premium position that people like kill for. I don't know. I think you could sneak one in every 6 years.
I know it's kind of hard. I also know it's kind of not hard. Buckeye talk. I will say one of the things that's weird is that it, like, Taylor Decker was drafted in 2016, and then Thayer Munford just feels like he took up a tackle spot every season since then. And he was a pick, not a first round pick, but he was a really good college football player and a very good Big Ten tackle. It wasn't like, oh no, what a disaster that they, you know, it's just that there's not a first rounder and he was a four year starter. So listen, that's again, I feel like this is probably like the fifth thing that we said on a podcast. It's like, and that's why Greg Stajaro is not the coach here anymore. That it's just, it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. It's Ohio State. It's very hard for something, some specific area to be bad, because they just don't let that happen. They just, the people are too good. The talent is too good. The resources are too plentiful. But it wasn't as good as the other position groups around him. And when you look at receiver and defensive back and defensive end, and then you go to the offensive line and you say, hey, there's five guys here. Hey, where's your first rounder? And it's like, and then it's like, okay, well, maybe it's not bad, but can we be better? And I think the answer to that question was yes. And however long Justin Fry's here or the next guy's here, I think there's an expectation of like Ryan Day is going to be knocking on the door saying, how many first rounders you got in your room right now? Because that's the expectation, and it should be.
Yeah, and that is part of the equation. All those little things are part of the equation. That's why I think this is more than just an academic exercise. I don't think Ohio State has to be positional you at any one given position at any time. I think it needs to be in the conversation at multiple positions, though. Mm-hmm. That tells you whether or not Ohio State actually is still at the top of college football, by whether or not it's still producing that talent up into the NFL. It's a cyclical thing or whatever, you know, it's a circle, but like you've got to keep feeding it. Like the guys have to be, if the guys are getting in the NFL and succeeding and staying there, that means you're producing talent. And if you're still producing talent, that means you'll eventually be getting more guys in the NFL. Like it all feeds off of each other. And I don't think Ohio State has to be DBU and edge rusher U and QBU and wide receiver U, but the fact that plausibly is contending for like all four of those things at once is why Ohio State is what it is.
And you think about it, where they are contending for it are at the premium positions, corner, mm-hmm. receiver, edge rusher, quarterback. And then the fifth one would be offensive tackle. So like that makes it even more. It's like, are you sending a bunch of guards to the NFL? You sending defensive tackles to the NFL? You sending linebackers and safeties and tight ends and even running backs? Well, that's not quite as much the deal. The deal is who is part of the passing game and who is part of stopping the passing game. And that's where they're in business, which is not a coincidence. And it is a reason for their success, and it's a reflection of their success. But it also is a change. I do, man, I want to make sure I finally found the things online that I was looking for for some stats on this, because Sports Source Analytics, which is a good Twitter account to follow, had done before the draft, had done some lists of things. And I actually have what I think feels like maybe they missed something here, but I just want to throw this out there just to get some last numbers out there. The previous 10 drafts before the one that just happened, they said there were five teams in the country that had at least 10 overall receivers drafted in the previous 10 years, not first round, obviously, but overall. LSU 14, Clemson 12, Alabama, Notre Dame, and Oklahoma 10. But by my count, Ohio State also has 10 in that 10-year period. Previous to this draft, they just didn't have any first rounders. But if you go back those previous 10 years, starting with, let's see, I've got, let me see the math. Wait, I have this. Oh, no. I have to search by receiver. It's guys like Devere Posey and Paris Campbell and Evan Spencer, Terry McLaurin, Curtis Samuel, Noah Brown, who's still in the league, Michael Thomas, Braxton Miller, Devin Smith, Devere Posey, right? I think those are the 10 guys. Like, those are real guys. They're just not first rounders. So I would say, I think they're tied for third before they just had two first rounders and a transfer first rounder that set the world on fire. So they were in that conversation as you were saying, they were in that conversation anyway at receiver. And that's how close they're going to be of like, hey, now if they all of a sudden start getting a bunch of first rounders, they can leap up and be the number one team there. By DBs, according to them, there were 11 teams. This is previous to this draft, the 10 drafts before this last one. There were 11 teams that had at least 10 defensive backs picked. They have LSU 18, Alabama 17, Ohio State 15. But again, that's where Ohio State's guys. Ohio State has 9 of those 15, or not quite 9, but a bunch of those, like 7 of those 15 are first rounders. So there's the quantity and then there's the quality. And that's why Ohio State clearly makes a case as DBU in the past decade, because they have as many total as anybody, but their dudes were super high and there's enough of them getting it done in the league. So they're not that far off in the past of being wide receiver U from a quantity standpoint, and their quality. They've got two studs in the NFL right now. And their quality of the draft picks, the number of first rounders is going to increase. So they're right there. They're gonna take that mantle, I think, pretty convincingly in a year.
Yeah, I think this is a conversation to maybe revisit every year after the draft and just see where things are trending. Because I think a year from now, depending on what kind of first year Olave and Wilson can have, this conversation could change again a little bit. We're going to come back from break. We're going to talk about some significant changes, one that has definitely happened in the NCAA, and some others that could be on the cusp. You're listening to Buckeye Talk. Doug, NCAA President Mark Emmert has stepped down. They call this a mutual parting of ways, even though I think Mark Emmert got a contract extension last year and makes a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little skeptical that he's walking away. You might want to dust his back for fingerprints, as my buddy back in Lafayette, Mike Carmen, used to say. But this is going to be a significant change at a time when the NCAA is undergoing significant change. Mark Emmert has been widely criticized for being
terrible,
just ineffective. Yes, but some combination of ineffective and not present. And overall not being the leader that was needed at a time when leadership was needed.
A lot of sins of omission, not commission. Yes. It's not that he did the wrong thing, it's that he did nothing.
Yes.
At a time when the entire amateur landscape of sports in this nation is undergoing a seismic shift, and it has felt like the organization that's supposed to be in charge of it was watching instead of doing. And that lands squarely on his lap, which everybody listening to this knows.
Yeah, I think if, you know, we only build statues to like the great leaders, but if there was some kind of a law that the NCAA had to build a statue for every outgoing president, I think his would just be like palms up, just like, it would just be a statue in Indianapolis of him going like, I don't know.
Is this my responsibility? What?
So I'm very curious where the NCAA goes with this, because I feel like, I mean, listen, the whole thing's blowing up and the NCAA has abdicated its influence in the most important reforms that have been happening to these sports in ever. So the NCAA is sort of stuck right now between protecting its interests and really needing an agent of change. And I don't know where they turn for leadership there. I was having an argument recently with a friendly argument, much like what we have here on the Buckeye Talk, and about some of the things you and I talked about last week on Madness, which was the way that coaches, NCAA coaches, spent a lot of time clutching their pearls in recent years when they could have been more proactive coming up with a better solution than what we have right now to things like NIL and the transfer portal. And as it pertained to NIL, a friend of mine said, that's true, but don't forget that it was the presidents who were dying on the hill of amateurism even more than the coaches were. And I think that's probably a fair point to make. And this is who, at the end of the day, do the presidents have more influence here, and who the NCAA president will be? I'm talking about university presidents, not separate from the NCAA presidents. And is it kind of like when we've talked about, even with Kevin Warren in the Big Ten, it's like, whose interests are you protecting and advancing? And how difficult then is it to be an agent of change when you still are kind of protecting the status quo or protecting the people who are the structure of the sports?
Well, every commissioner in every sport serves right at the behest of the owners in the sport. So it's like, oh, Rob Manfred in Major League Baseball does what favors the owners over the players. It's like, you think Roger Goodell, whose side's he on? They can get rid of him at any point. So the problem is that there's so many schools and sports, yes, and universities under the umbrella of the NCAA, and they don't all want the same thing.
Right.
So like somebody had made the point, like, so there's this transformation committee that I think we'll talk about a little bit, that they have their Ross Dellinger from SI.com has done some really good reporting on this. And we're leaning on a lot of his reporting for this conversation, that they're studying all these things that might change. And one of the co-chairs of that transformation committee is Greg Sankey, who's the commissioner of the SEC. And I know somebody somewhere was like, oh, Greg Sankey, maybe he could be the president of the NCAA. And it's like, he has more power now.
Right.
That would be a step down from commissioner of the SEC to president of the NCAA. So if you're the president of the NCAA, who are you supposed to serve? The 50 richest schools that kind of want to be able to do what they want and not have limitations on how much money they can spend and how they spend it? Or everybody else who's like, if you open the floodgates, we're not going to be able to keep up. Then you're going to bankrupt us or leave us hopelessly behind. Who are you supposed to serve? Currently, all of them. So while Mark Emmert was terrible at it, he was terrible at maybe an impossible job.
It's a really hard job.
Yep. So maybe the point of this is, you just can't have the NCAA be like this anymore. And you're going to have the top group and have their commissioner, and you're going to have everybody else and have their commissioner. And maybe there's some things where the rules apply to both, but there'll be some things, really important things, where the rules are very different. But I do think even though it's a really hard job, you still could get somebody better than Mark Emmert. And we're not going to pretend that we're experts on this stuff. I read a story by Dennis Dodd at CBS Sports, who's very into this kind of thing, who he had his whole list of candidates for this kind of job. But I will just say, I was looking at Mark Emmert's resume. I don't believe he was a college athlete. I actually have somebody, the type of person in my head, because I do think you have to have somebody who can, at this moment in time, while we're still like this, can bridge the gap a little bit between the gigantic athletic departments and huge schools with tons of resources and the everybody else group. And I actually have a person in mind who I think would maybe fit some of those qualifications.
Can I guess?
Yes.
Is it a person with Ohio State ties?
It is.
Is it Anthony Gonzalez?
It is not. Oh, you just blew my mind. That's really good. He needs a job.
Yeah, that's why he's, yeah, he wouldn't have to. It'd be one thing like, well, I'm not going to leave Congress to go be, but you're already leaving Congress. So
that's really good because I know mine's much more obvious. I know that a lot of people have said the last Mark Emmert was the president of the University of Washington, but he's been the NCAA president since 2010. He's been the president forever. Miles Brand before him, president in Indiana, right? Cedric Dempsey was the AD at Arizona back in the day before he was. So there's been a lot of people from the inside, right? And some people are saying, hey, let's get off the university president thing. Let's think outside the box. Condoleezza Rice, who's the, whenever there's a sports thing and it's like, huh, what if we got a sports person who wasn't really a sports person? Everybody goes to Condoleezza Rice because she was in government and she likes football and she was on the football committee. I'm not saying she wouldn't be qualified, but we just can't think of anybody else. Anthony Gonzalez is along those lines. It's a politician who likes sports with a sports background. I really like Anthony Gonzalez, but I think Christina M. Johnson would be a very reasonable candidate for this. She's a former college athlete. She's worked at universities like Johns Hopkins, and she was at State University of New York, SUNY, before she came to Ohio State. She's now at Ohio State. Again, she got right into the weeds in the pandemic of let's play Big Ten football, and these are the needs of my gigantic university where football is really important. I can see it from that standpoint, but that's not the only world that I've lived in. She understands the athlete experience. I think she certainly seems like a very smart, competent person from my very brief interactions with her. And she got down to business and served her university. And it's not the only thing, but we're talking about the sports part of it. Like somebody like that, a university president who actually understands athletes and could come at it from the big school perspective. Like I got to serve, you got to serve the Ohio States of the world. But I also understand everybody who's not an Ohio State person. Listen, who knows? But I think we just came up with two pretty good candidates right there, Nathan.
Well, when you started talking about the bridging the gap between big and small schools and someone with a background as university president, I thought you might be about to pitch Jim Tressel.
Oh,
but that would be tough, three. I think it'd be tough when you've had that many sanctions, when you basically got run out of the job. And I also think, Get your texts ready, the two or three of you who hate it when we say stuff like this. I think demographically, they should look more towards a Christina M. Johnson than a Jim Tressel. At this point in history, I think finding another Mark Emmert is bad optics. But I don't think that's a good reason to just say, because I think sometimes Condoleezza Rice is like the one black woman who has been involved in college sports at that level, even just tangentially with the football committee. So that's why her name keeps coming up. And that's the sort of thing that has to start changing. And elevating the Christina M. Johnsons of the world would sort of help do that. So if I would not be shocked, obviously, if this was a woman or a minority or both that they hire for this job.
And they have had a female NCAA president in the past. They have had a female president in the past. She was, Judith Sweet, I think was her name. She was a president for a short period of time. But I do think you have to try to get somebody who understands big school and everybody not a big school. I don't even want to say small school because it's like gigantic, unlimited resources, athletic department, and then everybody else, which is actually moderately big school, medium school, kind of big, small school, tiny. It's because it's so, because there's so few at the top. It's not even all 65 of the Power Five necessarily. It's like the top half of those 65, but they want to do what they want to do. And I think you have to find a way. I don't know if like an absolute cleaving of it's just two separate things. It's two, like they have nothing to do with each other. I don't know if that's the best or if you can find a way to say, well, here are the rules that govern everybody in these 10 areas. And then when it comes to what resources you can use and how you can pay athletes and how you can, the number of coaches you can have and those kind of things, well, then those rules are different for this group. And you can select which group you want to be in or something. I don't know if just like, that's it, we're done, it's two separate things is the way to go. And if you're not going to do that, if you're going to try to keep them together some way, I think you have to have somebody who understands and has lived in the shoes of both sides of that a little bit. So then to me, it's like, all right, well, then you're pulling somebody who's currently at one of the 30 big schools, which is somebody or understands one of the 30 big schools, which an Ohio State person would qualify for that. So would somebody at Texas and USC and Alabama and Florida State and everybody else, but who's come up through other avenues where they've dealt with the realities of places that have less money.
You're touching on something, and we don't have to go on this whole tangent, but I just want to make sure that we maybe stop and emphasize these things sometimes, because you're talking about like 30 big schools. I would say that those 30 big schools do not include, let's say, Illinois or Purdue, probably like don't fit in those top 30 schools right now. But if you're Illinois State or Ball State, you look up at Purdue and Illinois and you're like, my God, like what it would be like to have those resources and live on that level. And that I want people to keep that in mind as you kind of look at how that staggers down through college sports, that there are still these big gaps. And that doesn't mean teams don't compete well with each other through those gaps sometimes. But I mean, it's football revenue. It's football revenue. And as you mentioned earlier, the other thing we want to talk about, the 21 person transformation committee that Greg Sankey, the SEC commissioner, is chairing. Ross Dellinger is, man, if you guys don't follow Ross Dellinger on Twitter and like regularly read what he reports, he's about as good as there is really on reporting the national stuff. And I don't just mean like.
I will say I used to think he was not very good. I remember when he was off the LSU beat. And it was like Joe Burrow, like he got hired at SI.com after LSU won the national title. I was like, oh, so your school is national title and SI.com hires you. It's like he at the beginning was writing a bunch of LSU stuff. It's like, cool. Yep. You're just writing your beat for a national audience. But he has been all over like the transformation stuff from this standpoint, better than everybody else. So he does deserve a lot of credit for the reporting and the explanatory nature of like what is happening in college sports right now. So I've come around on Ross Dellinger.
He doesn't write like the sexy things. I mean, there's guys out there who are just texting coaches all day and they're doing the transactional stuff. And, you know, when the guy from Miami, who's now threatening to go in, the basketball player from Miami, who's threatening to go in the portal if he doesn't get a better NIL deal. Did you see that last night? Like that sort of stuff isn't what he reports on. It's more this like very nitty gritty, but really well sourced and deep stuff that helps explain big things that are going on in the sport. So there's basically this committee that is looking at how they're going to blow up the NCAA, basically. And the crux of it is that a lot of things are not necessarily going to be abolished, but they are going to be reverted back to the conferences to make the governing policy for it, which will then in turn probably abolish a lot of things. Here are some of the things that are on the list of transformations. Eliminating scholarship caps on non-revenue sports. So by and large, this is SEC schools that make money in baseball don't think they should be governed by the same scholarship policy as cold weather northern schools that don't. So they want to be able to give scholarships to all their baseball players.
So there's all these equivalency sports. I don't know. And this is one of those things. You guys don't have to know about this stuff. But the bottom line is, save for a few, well, the equivalency sports are actually the female sports that are full scholarship, right? To match up for the football stuff. There's a lot of sports where you don't have the full number of scholarships for people on the team. I think that you can have 35 baseball players in a roster, and there's 11.7 scholarships for the baseball players. And that's the rule.
Yes. If you were to go just do a survey of Ohio State's baseball team, you'd have a lot of guys on there. They're like, yeah, I get like an eighth of a scholarship.
Yeah.
Or a third of a scholarship or whatever. Like it's carved up pretty good. And then that's not to say there aren't full scholarships in baseball, but you better know who you're giving that to. Yeah. They do go out even for the northern teams, but man, no limits on coaches per team. and this would be across all sports right now, there's a 10 assistant coach limit in football. And then you have all of these guys that are getting hired in as quality control and all that stuff. And those guys can't do on-field instruction. It would basically be opening up on-field instruction to all those guys.
This one I actually don't like. I think you need to protect schools from themselves on this thing, because Alabama is going to hire 47 football coaches. And like, that's stupid. And that's not, I don't care how much money you have. And I don't care that you want to do whatever you want to do. There's a point where that doesn't make sense and stuff is bloated and there's better ways to spend that money. And I'm okay with the organization that you're part of telling you, I'm not letting you have 47 football coaches. Sorry. Maybe we'll raise it from 10 to 15 or whatever, and 10 are on field and the other five analysts, they're still called, whatever. I think it's okay to limit coaches, because here's the thing. The idea of, why are we limiting our ability to provide opportunities, and opportunities is an amateur code word for money, to athletes? Why are we doing that? There are clearly Title IX implications, and you have to keep things fair and equal and provide equitable opportunities. But why are we doing that? The scholarship limit on those other sports, there was a baseball coach who I saw come across my timeline who was like, yes, like a college baseball coach. Like, why are we doing this to our baseball players? Like, they're good enough. They're big time sports. Why are we limiting ourselves? So if the thing is, let's take away some of the limits on money we give to athletes, good. The idea of like, let's take away the limits on money that we blow on more adult middle managers, because we have so, there are 20 schools that have so much money, they don't know what to do with it. So let's hire another 20 assistant coaches at $400,000 each. That's stupid. That should be regulated and that should be limited, because listen, I get it. It's the professionalism of amateur sports, which is, I think, is fine. But as long as it is still nominally tied to educational institutions here, it's not 1,000% pro sports. It's not. And so if you're a university with that much money, go hire more chemistry professors. I don't need 47 football coaches. So I think that's a stupid regulation to take away. Nobody is saying, oh, man, it's killing us. We don't have enough coaches. Man, yeah. What are we going to do? We can't even coach these guys. We have 10 assistant coaches and the head coach. We have 85 players with the walk-ons. It's 105 players. That's like 10 players for every coach. I wish it was 2 players per coach. I wish we had 105 players and 105 coaches. So every player got individually coached all day. What do you want? There's a limit. Limit that.
Yeah, I was trying to remember going back to this, just to kind of emphasize that the equivalency sports thing. Dirk Chatelain, who is a reporter in Omaha, did a piece several years ago about how tough it is for the baseball players. And he was specifically doing one on baseball. And for, you know, as much as we were like lamenting, well, it's stupid that like Chase Young would have to try to borrow $200 to bring his girlfriend to the Rose Bowl or to the playoff or whatever. Like, now imagine that's a player who is making a fraction of that with his scholarship. Plus it's a person, you know, that you have to travel a lot more as a baseball player than you do as a football player, just like, and keep up with the same academic standards. So I think some reform there is overdue. Let's see, I'm going to get to the rest of the list and then make some more overarching points here. Expanding direct payments from schools to athletes. So right now you can give cost of living stipends, and you can now give some additional money in the form of it can be tied to sort of like academic performance. I assume that, you know, this would just expand on those things. Changing the recruiting calendar to basically just be an open period and a dead period, and cutting out all of these sort of weird havesy periods.
But the end result of that would be less recruiting time, right? That, yes. Like smaller windows in the end. I do think there's no reason for like coaches to be on the road at all. Like, the players have to, the high school athletes have to be able to get the information they need to make smart, informed decisions. But it doesn't have to be like this. The recruiting calendar makes no sense. So reforming the recruiting calendar, and as long as it's the same for everybody, it's right. fine. And as long as it's not such a small window that you have athletes are like, well, I wanted to do this. I couldn't go on this day. And then I couldn't go at all. And so then I didn't get to visit the school that I wanted to visit where I might want to go. Prevent that from happening. But it has to be better than it is right now.
Yeah. And by the way, those first three things I read off would still potentially fall under the ones that revert to this conferences. This is one that would probably still stay at the NCAA governance level in some way. You'd have to have some equality here, because then otherwise you'd be like, you know, the SEC or the Big Ten could just say like, no, we're going to have like open recruiting 365, and other conferences would have a tighter, and it just wouldn't work. So, and then the transfer, similar to that one, the transfer portal only being open for a 3 or 4 month period of the year instead of being this constant churn. I don't know if that would be a 3 month floating thing by sport, because obviously sport seasons end at different times, and you couldn't, you know what I mean? Like the football portal and the baseball portal probably need to be different.
No, for sure. Right. That it's tied to your season somehow. But again, you can have freedom without it being 365 day a year freedom, because people, logistics matter. And being able, programs being able to say, well, this is our roster, because every decision you make, that's the thing that people think about freedom. Everybody wants ultimate freedom to do whatever they want, without taking into account the times where what you do with your freedom has an effect on other people. So if what you do affects other people, maybe it's not 24-hour a day, 365 day a year, ultimate freedom. Or just go live in the woods if you want that. And then whatever you do won't affect anybody else. But every time somebody transfers or leaves, and then it's like, well, then now that means this person, the transfer in, might be taking a spot of another person, might have to transfer out. The transfer out says, oh, well, I didn't know that was. It's okay to have structure to the freedom. So I do think, I mean, there's no rules. Mark Emmert's like, what? Mark Emmert's listening to this, like looking up from his Chick-fil-A nuggets for lunch. He got the 12-pack because he was feeling a little frisky today. He knows that he shouldn't eat as many waffle fries as you get if you do the large size, but he's getting booted out. He treated himself. Mark's looking up from his line. I like to listen to podcasts during lunch. What?
It's emotional eating.
Yeah.
Emotional eating. He's being booted.
He's both sad, but also rewarding himself for what he perceives incorrectly as a job well done. So he's like, what? Regulate the portal? I didn't know you could make rules as the president of the NCAA. It's like, yeah, no, you're allowed to make rules. So, I mean, this is, there's a way to get players the freedom they need while creating a more reasonable atmosphere where everybody can function.
But I think you're getting at the crux of the issue here, which is, and by the way, they also, Dellinger's reporting said things like the infractions process, automatic qualifiers for national tournaments, revenue distributions, like those would also potentially all also be up for some structural changes. But the whole point of this is the NCAA president can't really unilaterally implement some of these things. And that's why I think they're looking at sending it to the conferences and letting the conferences make decisions on some of these things and take over the governance on them. I don't know if that works. I don't know, because on the one hand, and we always like to look at these things through the lens of, is it good for Ohio State, or what would it mean for Ohio State? What would it mean for the Big Ten? And the Big Ten has the money to implement kind of whatever it wants and to be a very like athlete friendly conference, but will it have the will to do that, or will it stubbornly take a less progressive stance because it doesn't want to lose control? Because that has been there's just been a hesitation across the board for so long to implement these reforms, and the people within the Big Ten, you know, Gene Smith served on the NIL committee that the NCAA put together a couple years ago, or the, I don't remember. I don't think it was called the NIL committee, but he had a committee chairmanship on or co-chairmanship. You know what I'm talking about, right? Can you articulate better than I am?
It's fine. People know what you're talking about. It's a group.
And again, it was one that kind of came back and another example of where I didn't feel like there was ever a solution that was proposed. It was more just like a, well, here's what we need to be wary of when this change comes. Like, So I don't know. I'm skeptical that the individual conferences would be, or maybe even the Big Ten in particular, would be progressive enough to take advantage of this.
Well, so the issue is, it's not, to me, it's not really a conference thing. It's a resources thing. So conferences are like-minded typically in the approach. So you can say Ohio State and Purdue and Rutgers and Nebraska and Iowa all think generally the same kind of thing about how athletics fits into college life. And Alabama and Kentucky and Tennessee and Texas A&M and other schools all think roughly the same way. But when it comes to implementing it, Ohio State and Purdue are in the same conference, but they're not on the same level. And Alabama and Vanderbilt are in the same conference, but they're not on the same level. Alabama, when it comes to implementing it, Alabama and Ohio State have much more in common with each other than Alabama and Kentucky have in common, or than Ohio State and Indiana have in common. So there's the like-minded thinking, but then there's the, hey, let us spend our money the way we want to spend it. And if you're saying it's a money issue, we're going to let you spend the money the way you want to spend it. We're going to take some of the regulation off how you pay players, how you pay staff, those kind of things. I don't think that's a conference decision. Like, I don't think that that's like, oh, the SEC is all going to think the same way about that, or the Big Ten's all going to think the same way, or the Big 12's all going to think the same way. Because USC is going to be like, cool. And Oregon State's going to be like, what? And the same things. So that's why I think, again, it's, to me, a lot of this stuff is, if they're saying, well, we're going to let the conferences have more power, it's much more about top 30 than it is this group of 14 people who are geographically near each other. So I'll be curious to see if they give the freedom to smaller groups. Everybody wants smaller regulation. You don't want, if you're Alabama, you don't want somebody in Oregon telling you how to spend your money because you're in a different part of the country. But you also don't want UAB, which is in your same state, telling you how to spend your money because they have 1/50th of the resources you do. But I do think in the end, it's more of a resources issue than a conference issue. So to give it to the conferences, does that sound like, oh, we'll let the conferences decide. Right. Does that mean everything's going to be great then? That solves it?
Right. I think you're getting at what I was trying to say, which is it seems like it may unfold as another version of where Ohio State uses less power than it has. And still, it is still maybe confined within the structure of the Big Ten.
Right, which is the case now, but the more, it's the case for everybody now. So everybody's constrained in some way. But if you let conferences decide, and let's say the SEC is like, go, do anything you want, spend money however you want to, on any athlete and any staff member. And the Big Ten doesn't do that, but then Ohio State has to try to go compete nationally against SEC schools. And no, not everybody else in the Big Ten is not worried about that the same way. I think it amplifies the currently existing thing, which is Ohio State has more power than it uses. But if the Big Ten constrains and the SEC doesn't anymore, how long is that tenable for Ohio State? Because it's fine now, but you're maybe increasing the gap. So I don't think it's a conference solution in the end, which a lot of people, which everyone's been saying, it's a tier solution, which is why everybody in for 5 years has been theorizing about the top 30 break off and do their own thing. And you have a super conference that is one super conference that is from coast to coast, from Mexico to Canada. And it's just the big schools. And in the end, especially because Ohio State, which is why it's fun to talk about this kind of stuff through the Ohio State lens, is because Ohio State is a gigantic SEC-like athletic department within a conference that doesn't want to act like the SEC. And that creates tension. And how Ohio State specifically works that out is about as interesting as it gets in conversations like this.
And Gene Smith has been one of the people who has most argued that we need federal regulation as it applies to NIL. And I know that some people, and maybe even myself at times, that has looked like a a continued like abdication of this by NCAA authority figures, you know, looking if somebody come in from outside and fix this problem. But if you start talking about this splintering to down to the conferences having more power governing each of these things, that's where something like NIL at the federal level maybe is more necessary. And starts to give them some guidelines to work with. And you already have that for something like Title IX. Like if you were to dissipate all this power to the conferences, they would still be governed by Title IX as far as like how you have opportunities for equal opportunities for males and female athletes. Would they need something like that to help kind of give them guidelines as it pertains to NIL? Because people are starting to lose their mind a little bit about where this NIL stuff is headed.
No, the NIL stuff, they have to get a handle on this to some degree as well. That would not limit the ability of athletes to make money. But again, as we've talked about before on this podcast, no sport where you are attempting to create some kind of equal playing field in the name of competition, no sport like that is completely capitalistic. Anybody can do whatever they want at any time. It can change teams whenever they want. It can get any amount of money they want. That is not how any sport functions. It's not. So if you are arguing against that, argue against every sport that exists. Because even in Major League Baseball, where there's no salary cap, there's a limit on what you can earn when you come in as a young player. There are limits. So when we act like, well, every 19-year-old has to have complete freedom for everything, it's like, okay, good luck with playing with blowing up your competitive balance. And let's not act like competitive balance is not some kind of worthy goal for big time sports competition. It is. I do think in the end, most of this stuff though, just comes down to whether you want federal regulation, whether it's from the NCAA or Congress and the federal government, or whether you want conference regulation or freedom for the schools. It's no different than politics. Do you want federal regulation or do you want state regulation? This goes back to Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. It's no different. Do you want local control or national control? Now, the issue is if you want local control here, you then go out and play for national championships. You don't only play for local championships. So if you're going to have a bunch of people playing by very different sets of rules because people are hell-bent on local control, it's going to skew when you come together, because the playing field's not going to be level. So to me, at some point, how can you have no national regulation when you have national championships? There's no overarching rules. Everything's at the conference level. That's crazy to me. How can that be? Then we don't have national champions anymore. Alabama can be the champion of Alabama. It's Alabama, Auburn, UAB, and Alabama State. There's a 4-team football tournament every year, and Alabama gets to raise the Alabama trophy. Great. But if we want to do more than that, you have to give in to some kind of federal coast-to-coast regulation on some level. And if that means we do away with geographic identity at the highest level, and we agree to constraints based on money, so Alabama is constrained to some degree, but barely, because USC and Texas and Ohio State and Florida State and Clemson can all keep up. So they have minimal regulation on the 30 richest athletic programs and go. Then I think that's where you have to wind up. Because if it's about conferences and states, the local areas with the least regulation are just going to win every year. And at some point, that's not that fun. And then people would say, you mean like now, how the SEC wins everything in football? And I would say, yeah, I know, like now, but worse, but even more. So I don't know why. Like they have a body, they have a national body. It's just so ineffective. People are like, let's just not have that anymore. And I don't know that that's actually the solution.
I want to make one real quick point before we go to break. You make a good point about how there isn't a free-for-all in the pro sports. All those things, even when there's freedom, it's very structured. But as we said ad nauseum, what's the main difference between the two levels? All those things at the pro level are collectively bargained. All those things, the players have a representative body. They get to be involved with how the structure of those things are set up. and that doesn't exist at the college level. So that's, and that's one of the reforms I did not see mentioned in this. They did, there was a, Dellinger did say that they had broached the topic of athletes as employees, but had not come up with a proposal for that yet. But until that relationship also still needs to be hashed out. This is still a lot of things that are being dictated to the human beings who populate the thing that we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. In a world, in a world where, well, yeah, there's no reason to get anymore. I was going to talk about Starbucks unions, but nobody wants to hear that on Buckeye Talk. But I mean, like, that's right. So it's just the reality. It's clunky as all heck. And we don't, I don't love talking about it. It does make my head explode a little bit. And I do think the idea of this, the thing you briefly mentioned about the basketball player who has an NIL agent who negotiated other good NIL deals for other players at his school. And now that agent is saying, hey, these other players have better deals than this guy. I negotiated those. You better give this guy stuff or he's leaving. Like, I don't love that. Players should be able to make outside money, but that's not how it works necessarily. I mean, like, you can sit out, right? But that's not how it worked. You can't just leave. In sports, you sign contracts. You can't just threaten to leave. Now, James Harden, I get it. And players do, and they force their way out. But, like, you can't regulate that some way, that there's some kind of, the money's tied to a commitment on some level. And the reason that it's not is because the NCAA is so jacked up right now. But I don't know that that's, is that where everybody thinks we should be? Players should be allowed to make outside money. And now we're at the point where if you don't give me a good, as good of an NIL deal as my teammate, I'm going to transfer, or I'm going to threaten, even if you just transfer, but to threaten to transfer, eek. And that's not, that's just about competitive balance in any sport and the way it functions. I don't think that's not the long-term functionality that people want for the sport, I don't think.
And this is where I think it's going to be, which side do coaches take? If you're Larinaga down at Miami, do you just call his bluff and let him leave? And, or do you give in or allow your boosters to give in, I guess, in this case, because it's not money that's coming directly from you. And then are you just feeding the worst version of this? It's, I understand they are in a bad problem, but as a bad situation, but as I said last week, the coaches helped create this. Like, there wasn't enough of a, they had an incredibly influential voice that they did not use to help come up with a better system than this. It's one of the reasons why we're here. I'm not necessarily blaming them in totality, because I think there was also misguided trust placed in the NCAA to come up with a better framework than this, but they didn't help themselves. And now they're the chickens are coming home to roost. Is that the phrase? I think that's what I mean.
But is your attitude like, oh, well, you did this to yourself. Sorry, sport exploding.
Well, I think the problem is, I understand.
Like, what's the solution?
Yeah, I think the NCAA it comes down to, like, I mean, not to use a technical term, but I think it comes down to legal stuff at some point, right?
But what's your solution? What's your Nathan Bear? What should they do? Is this just the way it is?
I think if I were doing it, I guess I would be fine with making things more enforceably, like a commitment that's more enforceable. But I don't know where that sits legally. If they are actually an amateur, if the income is coming from somewhere else, that's the problem. You want to be able to tie the compensation of a player to the school. And I know they're getting scholarships, but you want to be able to tie this, the totality of their commitment to the school, but the school is only responsible for some or none of the compensation. Mm-hmm. And those two things colliding right now is what's causing the problem.
There's no sport that has zero regulation on how players get to the teams initially. All pro sports have a draft. There's no draft in college sports. It's all recruiting. You pick and decide. So those athletes actually have more freedom than they're going to have later. You can decide to go wherever you want to go.
And now also you have ultimate freedom to leave at any point and go wherever you want to go a second time, which no pro athlete has. They earn that right. So that is two levels of unfettered freedom for the athlete. And now you're going to tell a school, I'm going to transfer if I don't get more NIL money. Like, again, you have to probably figure it out with an employment agreement. And that's right. Where this goes. But how can this be the thing? How can this be? This cannot be it.
What's happening right now is the transition from treating college sports and college athletes as they are, not as they wish they were, I think is what we're really talking about here. Like the conditions have already existed here as far as everything we've been talking about for the past 10 years as it relates to this concept. And now it's just a matter of a very messy transition towards accepting that and actually then basing the laws around that as opposed to what we wish was still in play from 40 years ago.
And what they could really use in a town like this is a freaking leader, and they don't have one.
We brought it all back around to the front of the conversation. We are not going to talk about Starbucks unions. We are going to talk about food and some other nonsense. We come back from break here on Buckeye Talk. I'm going to go first on Watcha Watch and Much Eaten because I'm still deciding what I want to say about my Watcha Watch. But my Watcha Eaten is once in a while you encounter a condiment that.
This sounded like the opening line of an Oscar-winning documentary. Once in a while you encounter a condiment.
And I have encountered such a condiment. There is a Brazilian restaurant. Is it Brazilian? I think it's a tapas, South American restaurant here in Columbus called Arapazo. There used to be one in Gahanna also. I don't know if you would have been more familiar with that one. Some of our listeners probably were, but I think that location actually recently closed. So they only have the one on High Street now, South High Street. They are known for a lot of things. They're known for their empanadas, which are fantastic.
Love empanadas.
Oh, I don't know if we've ever brought up empanadas in the meat stuff dough conversation, but they're very high on my list. I went to a wedding one time. You know, sometimes at the wedding, you have like the food that gets brought in late, like the late night food, like after all the dancing and stuff. And one of them I went to just had like towers of empanadas, and it was amazing. And I ate way too many of them.
There's a restaurant in New York City that I came across called Empanada Mama. That is
there.
I made you go to Empanada Mama. There's like, yeah, I forgot that. There's like 50 different kinds of empanadas. It's one of my favorite restaurants. Awesome.
It was really good. If you go to Arapazo, they have their own that they make cilantro sauce. And there's like a mild version and a spicy version. We always get the spicy version. You can buy it by the bottle and bring it home. So we like to make sure we go to Arapazo every couple months because we have to get a new bottle of cilantro sauce and bring it home. And you can put it on everything. We made fish tacos earlier this week that we put it on. I made like eggs and fried potatoes for breakfast the other day. You put them on the potatoes. It's a very versatile condiment, and it's delicious. And if you like spicy food, especially, get the spicy version. It's not like killer, blow your mouth out spicy, but it's got enough of a kick to it that it's just a fun dining experience. So that's my recommendation, the cilantro sauce from Arapazo.
What's cilantro taste like?
Cilantro is an herb. It's like if you get authentic tacos, if you go to a taqueria, yeah. You're getting just onions and cilantro on a taco.
Is cilantro the thing that some people think tastes like soap?
Yes. I weep for those people because cilantro is maybe my favorite herb, my favorite like leafy thing to add to things.
Isn't that weird? Aren't there a couple things about the human condition where it feels like God was just having a little fun? And it's like, I'm going to have a thing where 95% of the people think this thing tastes good. And 5% of the people think it tastes like soap. It's like, what are you doing? It's like, he's just like, it's fine. It's no big, it's not hurting anybody, but I just wanted to see if I could do it. It's like, yep, you did it. Well, that makes me want to get cilantro sauce. Cause I don't think it tastes like soap. So that's good.
It's really good.
Mine is going to be about Reese's peanut butter eggs because we just got done with Easter and I grew up in the town next to Hershey, Pennsylvania. Reese's is a Hershey company, the Reese's factory. I 3 miles from my house, drove past it a gazillion times in my lifetime. Very deep connection to Reese's. And there was a time. So there's the Reese's cup and then there's the Reese's egg. And I am very interested in the peanut butter to chocolate ratio of any Reese's product. And over time, they have really started changing a lot of stuff around. But one of the main things that changes is what is the peanut butter to chocolate ratio? Because a regular cup, it is much more chocolate to peanut butter than the egg. The Reese's egg, which was for an Easter egg, is just much more peanut butter. And that's my ratio. So I always look, I want more peanut butter. I'm actually not a gigantic chocolate guy. I'm a huge peanut butter guy. So I want more like a 4-to-1 peanut butter to chocolate ratio. And I feel like a regular Reese's cup is more like a 2-to-1 peanut butter to chocolate ratio. So I love the eggs. And there was this time where like, that was my, it was like Easter would come around. It's like, it's Reese's eggs. It's more peanut butter. And then they figured it out. Now there's Reese's hearts at Halloween. Then you go into the eggs. Or no, not Reese's hearts at Valentine's. Then yes, you go into the eggs. Then there are Reese's pumpkins at Halloween. And then there are Reese's trees at Christmas. So they figured out that people want that different ratio of peanut butter to chocolate year round. And they just made up an excuse for the most seasonal shape they could figure out to say, that's the shape we'll make, but it's about the ratio. And I do think, Nathan, I do think some people like, they have smaller Reese's, which then the ratio becomes almost like 1-to-1 chocolate to peanut butter, which I don't like that. That's too much chocolate. And I obsess. And then they have like the, now they have just bigger cups year round where again, it's a bigger peanut butter ratio. I love Reese's products, but the ratio is the whole thing. And I spend a lot of time thinking about that. And that's how I choose my Reese's products, what fits my ratio. Do you think about peanut butter to chocolate ratio in the same way? And what do you have a preferred ratio for those products?
So as before, I was bemoaning those who think that cilantro tastes like soap. My wife has a nut allergy, peanuts and tree nuts, and which means I might as well have one because it's hard to have peanut butter that's like still on your face or hands or like wrappers laying around. She's not one of those people that like, if you smell it from, if it happens like three floors away, their face still blows up or whatever, but it's obviously bad if she ingests it. So I love chocolate and peanut butter, and I like peanut butter just on its own, but it's almost like a, if I'm away from home by myself, if I'm on a road trip, I can indulge in like something peanut butter related. But before all this, one of my favorite candy experiences is the Reese's dark chocolate cups and the ones that just come individually, which might as well, there might as well just be one huge one. Cause I'm just going to eat like 20 of the little ones. About as good as it gets. If people have never tried that, I highly recommend it.
But that's a much more chocolate ratio. There's because the smaller you get, the more chocolate there is. And you enjoy that ratio.
Yeah, I'm probably more of a chocolate over peanut butter ratio than you are.
Okay. Yeah. And I love that. It's not actually peanut butter. It's that fake, flaky, whatever, fake substance of peanut butter. It's like astronaut peanut butter. I love it. I love fake peanut butter. I don't even know what that substance is. Delicious. I'm envisioning you now, though, up at the altar, you and your wife getting married, and the minister is about to start the vows, and she leans in and says, by the way, I have a nut allergy. And you're like, your life is like flashing before your eyes. You're like realizing I'm about to give up peanut butter for the rest of my life. You didn't have a moment where you were like, do I love her as much as I need to give up peanut butter? What was that like for you?
You know, it's not that much of a workaround, really. I mean, we still make a ton of ice cream together. So it's not like I'm not getting all those same kind of treats. And we still, you know, we can make other desserts. The things that are tricky are like, because if you go look at like any candy you buy at a store, a lot of them say made in a facility that Now, if it's made in a facility that also had peanuts and tree nuts, which you're going to have to do for liability, that's not a problem. If it says it's made on the same machinery, that's the problem. Okay. But there are also some companies that have figured out, like if you go buy just a regular Hershey bar, those are made in a facility that don't come in contact with nuts, and they're not even in the facility. They're made in like a separate facility. So like they've figured out there's some other candy companies like Charleston Chews are fine, and I think Junior Mints are fine. Milk Duds may even be fine. Like some companies have figured out to make certain things off of the nut machines. The other thing that trips us up sometimes is Chinese food. Like I love like just like Chinese takeout and stuff, but obviously there's peanuts around that all the time. Or like things like donuts, you kind of have to go to maybe a nut-free bakery to get things like that. But it's really not a huge. I will take a nut allergy over with my spouse over like maybe like a dairy allergy. Seems like it would be a much bigger problem. Or people that can't have gluten because of celiac or whatever, and you have to only do gluten-free breads and pizza crusts and all that stuff. Like that just that seems like way more hassle than what we go through.
Every time you talk about you and your wife making ice cream at your house, the picture in my head, and I always rail against Seinfeld references because they're 40 years old, is when Kramer and Newman are making the sausage in Jerry's apartment and they're cranking the sausage scene and going dun dun dun, dun and like they're pictured that's how you're on the crank and your wife and you're dancing in your kitchen making ice cream. Is that pretty close to it?
No, to be fair, of late, it's actually been more her, like it's one of her big hobbies to make. Like right now we have a Oreo cheesecake ice cream in our freezer that is spectacular.
Interesting.
All her creation.
All right.
What you watching?
So I'm watching High School Musicals. So my daughters were in Footloose over the weekend. And I just want to give a shout out to, I'm old. When I was in high school, and I think I've realized since then that maybe my high school just wasn't into that very much. But like the idea when I was in high school, of like, hey, you do a musical. I was like, that would have never even crossed my mind. It's like, how did people do that? That doesn't seem like something that high school students could do. And at least in my town, there are three high schools and they all put on multiple musicals a year. And they always have signs up around town. If there is a high school musical in your community, maybe you don't have kids. Maybe your kids are not of age. Maybe your kids are moved out of the house. But when you see the sign on the corner and it's like, there's a High School Musical this weekend, go to one. Because they are very good. It amazes me what 17 and 18-year-olds can do. And as long, listen, there's some boring musicals, but they did Footloose. And it's a very entertaining musical. And to watch the production numbers and all these things, it kind of blows my mind. I don't know how like I would have done something like that in high school. I don't know that I would have liked to try. I wish my high school did it. So I would just like go watch one of those. If you have a random Friday night or a random Saturday afternoon, it's musical season. A lot of schools are probably already done with them. Some still are doing them. If you've never seen one, just go see one. I took my kids when they were little, probably 10 years ago to one. We went and saw Legally Blonde at the high school that they're at now. And it was awesome. We went and saw Snoopy, Peanuts the Musical one time. And then like the kids come out at the end. And my kids met the kids who were in Peanuts the Musical. It was like they're meeting Broadway stars. They were like, oh my gosh, how good you are. So it's just a really fun community experience. And if you think to yourself, I don't know, high school production, it's like, if they're putting the time into it, it's probably going to be pretty good and worth your time. So get off your couch. Give up Netflix for a night and go see a High School Musical.
I went to a high school out in the middle of a bean field. So we didn't really have, by the time I got to high school, the auditorium that used to exist there had been like converted into some other thing. We didn't really have a theater production situation. They had one room they kind of repurposed into that. So I did some plays in like elementary school. There was like a gifted program thing where I did some plays. I was the wizard in the Wizard of Oz once.
That tracks.
And I was there was something we did about like John Henry, and I was like the narrator and I had to blow on this train whistle. I don't remember the specifics of that one. But before that, when I was younger, I remember going to that same school when the auditorium was still there because I had a cousin who was in, they were doing a production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. Which I don't remember how much that actually correlates to the actual Charlie Brown cartoon. But anyway, I remember, I can like still remember like sort of like this, the way that that felt and seemed. And I agree with you. Like, I've walked by like other high schools around here and you'll see like they're advertising their plays. And I've said to my wife, like, oh, we should like go to those sometime. And we just haven't. So
yeah,
maybe it's something, maybe it could be the first time we dump the kid off with the babysitter. It'll be to go to a
babies love high school plays. Babies love them.
My watching real quick. We've been, we always have like something that we watch as we're falling asleep at night. And lately it's been 30 Rock. It's usually just like a recent comedy. And I was reminded as we went back through it, we just had the episode recently. It's my favorite joke in television history. And for people who haven't seen 30 Rock, there's a lot of things that are kind of like a Family Guy vibe where like they'll say something and it'll immediately cut to like a past scene. And the main character that Tina Fey plays and then Jane Krasinski is like the ditzy blonde star of this TV show that Tina Fey runs. And they were friends together in Chicago. And one of them makes a reference to like that time we did improv in Chicago. And it cuts to this scene of them both sitting down in a chair. And the prompter says, Sling Blade and Oprah go on a date. And Tina Fey sits down and says, man, I sure do love them French fried potatoes. And Jane Krasinski says, no, you don't, Oprah. It's my favorite joke in television history. So there's a lot of them on 30 Rock, though. It moves really fast. And if you've never watched 30 Rock, I recommend it because it's not a show that you can skip around. You can fall asleep in the middle and come back three episodes later. And the timeline doesn't really matter. It's fun. It bounces around. A lot of good jabs. Fun show.
I like 30 Rock. To me, it's the starkest example. I thought the pilot of 30 Rock was abysmal. And I was excited for it. You like Tina Fey from Saturday Night Live. And I watched and I was like, this is awful. And then they figured it out by episode two. But it's like, it's one of the craziest things. I'm like, man, if they, their pilot was bad enough that I thought the executive been like, well, you tried it, Tina Fey. Didn't work. We're done. And then they got it together after that.
I think there's a lot of shows like that. I think the first season of Parks and Rec is pretty flat for me. And then they got it going. I think there's a lot of shows like that, that it takes like a little bit of time. And I think 30 Rock was probably, you had to like get the concept of it settled and then let the zaniness all play around it. And so I could see that, but I think we're several seasons into the rewatch here and it's pretty fun. All right. So this is actually probably it for me. This is probably like the actual last thing. We're recording this on a Friday afternoon, no later than Saturday night. We're going into the hospital to bring this kid into the world. So I'll see you all in a couple of months. Before Doug Lee Maurice, I'm Nathan Baird, and that was Buckeye Talk.